right.
Okay, we're a little late, but that's because people like to talk. But welcome to the BitTorrent happy 10th birthday.
Where's the cake?
I ate it.
The cake is a lie. That's right.
No, we ate it at Hacking 201 last night. We got really hungry. My name's Ketch. I'm a researcher specializing in P2P systems. I work for torrentfreak.com, among other places.
My name's CJ Myhill. I'm an attorney. I deal with intellectual property and business litigation. I'm just here to handle any legal questions. I'm going to let Andrew do most of the time.
Okay, so, and what is it? What year is it now?
It was a rough night last night.
In 2001, Bram Cohen released the first draft of BitTorrent in July 3rd, to the public, and it's basically supplanted, over the last 10 years, every other P2P system. Now, might be Usenet might be more popular overall, but Usenet's not really P2P. And it's more of a one-to-one file sharing system, but why has it become so dominant? Well, first of all, how many here use BitTorrent? Come on, I'm not a Fed. I'm not going to...
Yeah, but he's an attorney. All
right, I'll give you a disclaimer.
That's right. Well,
that's a trick question, actually, okay? Because effectively what they're saying is using BitTorrent is illegal. That's mm-hmm. one of the things they're trying to say. That's like saying a guy in California robbed a bank with a car. We're going to outlaw all the cars. Yep. Backtrack 5 is distributed by the authors using BitTorrent. And right now, my machine's seeding it right over at Georgia Tech because they were kind enough to give me some really awesome tools for free. I figured I owed them back.
And that's it. I mean, remember that the whole idea of BitTorrent and any of the P2P systems was that they have substantial non-infringing uses, and therefore the technology itself is perfectly legal. Now, if he asks you all to say, you know, raise your hand if you downloaded some infringing illegal material today, I would all suggest that you keep your hand down. At least stay off the radio. But
okay, let's try. Anybody who hands up all those who downloaded any infringing material? One.
Yeah.
Always one joker.
Yep.
That's true. Yeah, that is for the courts.
There you go. So, but that's a very important thing to remember is that while there are illegal activities that occur on the software, the software is fine. The technology is perfectly legal. Everything about it is legal. YouTube is perfectly legal, even though there may occasionally be an infringing video or two. I mean, I know that comes as a surprise to everyone, but there is infringing stuff on YouTube. But it's fine. So the use of the technology, no problems.
In fact, all the audio from last year's and the year before's is actually available not only just on BitTorrent, but it's actually on the Pirate Bay website itself. And this year's audio will also be available via BitTorrent and on the Pirate Bay website.
After everything we said about the Pirate Bay last panel, oof.
They won't mind, trust me. They say it themselves. So one of my other jobs is I'm a frontline support for uTorrent. And in a past life, I used to run the US Pirate Party and then Pirate Party International. So I got a bit of a background for the support of the BitTorrent system as well. So there seems to be some hands tweaking up.
Is MuTorrent considered...
MuTorrent, it's the same thing. It's Ludwig Strigius said, wrote it as Mu, but it's he more usually pronounced it UTorrent. Mu is in micro. Mu is in microtorrent. Microtorrent's also a thing, but UTorrent is the usual accepted pronunciation. Yes, sir.
So I downloaded the original client back in the day, and
the Bram Cohen's Python one.
It works well, but then it didn't, and I ended up downloading
Azurius,
whatever the frog one was.
Azurius.
Now that's
now
something
booze.
Else.
Yes, booze.
What's the deal with that? Are they just updating the GUI? Are they modifying the code?
With which the BitTorrent client itself, the original one?
Yeah. Well, what's with all the different incarnations?
Okay. Let's see. Around about 2005, a lot of additions started being added on. It's an open protocol, so there can be additions to it. And around 2005, there were a bunch of them. One of them was what's called DHT, or Distributed Hash Table. And that allows for torrents to be tracked without using a tracker. So where traditional networks were one network all joined together, like Napster, one network all joined at one hub. Well, then subsequent ones like Kazaa and
Grokster,
yeah, were more of a decentralized network, but they were all still one network together. Well, BitTorrent is lots and lots of separate networks, each dealing with just one torrent at a time, effectively. Some of them may be, and then you've got the central hubs, trackers, may deal with 200,000 torrents at once, but it's still dealt with each one separately. So every single one is decentralized. Distributed hash table then re-merges them all together, but instead of in a bunch of central servers, it does so via all the clients themselves. So that was the first major add-on, was all the distributed hash tables, so that you didn't need a tracker, and if a tracker went down, you could still continue the torrent. And to go with that, because of what's commonly called private trackers, how many have heard of private trackers, let's say? How many have heard of them very well?
Don't worry, I'm not on duty.
They're called private trackers. They're not. If anything, they're less private than public trackers. When you go into a public tracker or an open tracker, like the Pirate Bay's old one, you don't need to give them any information. They get your IP address. When you go into these private trackers, you've got to give them an email address, a username, a password. You've got to log on to it each time. They'll log your IP address. They'll log how much data you uploaded, how much you downloaded, which torrents you were on at which time. And they'll keep that, because that's your ratio, and ratio is important. Now, a lot of them as well will beg and beg and beg for donations. And when you get donations, that means money, and money means?
Yeah, money's trackable. Pretty easily trackable.
A better name for private trackers is a registration required tracker, but it doesn't have the same ring to it, and it doesn't give an exclusivity.
It's also called evidence.
Exactly. Yeah. What was the key point of evidence in Jamie Thomas's trial?
Jamie Thomas.
Thomas Rassett, the 1.92 million Kazaa case.
Yes. Yes. Trying a blank.
Her username.
Yep.
TerraStar. That was the key piece of evidence, probably in the entire case, was that the username she provided to Kazaa was the same as she used in other aspects. That was the basis of the entire case. And they've now just gone back to an appeal on the third trial. It's been going on for 6 years.
One of the biggest things that stymies people in online copying of any sort is finding the actual infringer. That's why so many people are trying to shut down the sites. That's why people go after YouTube. That didn't work, so now then they go after Napster, they go after Grokster, they go after Pirate Bay, because otherwise I had to find the infringer. And finding the infringer online when everyone is just anonymous and passing through can be very, very difficult. Finding it when you have a username can be hard, but not nearly as hard as when you don't. And finding it when you have a username that ties to somebody's email address, that ties to somebody's credit card, yeah, that's pretty clear.
Going back to your question about what's changed. These private trackers didn't like distributed hash tables, DHT. So they wanted a separate way to block that. So that was another thing called private flags. A little flag you set in it, it changes the hash, and now anything but the tracker can't be used to find peers. So they keep their exclusivity. Then there was the introduction of UDP instead of TCP. You've got UDP trackers, and you now have UDP transfer through what's called the UTorrent Transfer Protocol, or UTP. And it's this evolution of the protocol over the last 10 years that's meant that your client's not really... It will work, but not very well. It won't connect to a lot of people. There's been protocol encryptions that have been added to deal with throttling and traffic management. So it's all of these things that, I mean, it would work if other people are using your client or compatible with yours settings, but a lot of people aren't these days, and so that's why you had to go to a newer one like Vuz or Azurius, as it was called. Okay, anyone else? I do tech support questions on BitTorrent as well. Anyone?
It's a little web. It's got disinfectant on it, so you don't get conflict.
Thank you. I would prefer not to have Ebola. Okay. On uTorrent, I haven't tested it out lately, but one thing I noticed a while back is that when I, in order to conserve my bandwidth, because Comcast, being the evil bitches that they are, decide to put caps on unlimited internet,
mm-hmm.
I would heavily limit the amount of seeding that I do.
Okay.
But that would also enormously, if not completely, throttle down the download speed.
Okay.
Is that something that's built into uTorrent to be like that, or is that something that is just the nature of BitTorrent to begin with?
It's more of what's built into the torrent. The torrent protocol itself is what's called tit for tat. So you give me a piece, I'm more likely to give you a piece back. So the more you throttle back your thing, the best phrase is a client uploads in preference to clients that have uploaded mostly to it. So you upload lots to it, it says, he's a great peer. He's great. I'm going to give him lots because he shared a lot with me. And that keeps good peers going, and it encourages sharing. So it's not specific to uTorrent. They used to have a hard-coded, you set it really low, then it would actually physically throttle your, well, not physically, not going to jump on your line, but it's going to actually limit how much the client will actually accept, but it doesn't anymore, not since 2007. Now, let's see. What can we talk about?
yeah, I really expected more questions.
Yeah.
Okay, there we go.
What's the best way to be anonymous when downloading torrents, like through use of VPNs and stuff like that?
Well, VPNs generally have one problem. Well, two problems. The first one is, you have to pay for them, and paying for them means?
Trackable.
The second one is, who's running the VPN? Paul Toppins yesterday at the WikiLeaks panel, I think it was yesterday. Hang on, what day is it? It's Monday. Monday, okay. I think it was yesterday then. Talked about how WikiLeaks got started, and they latched onto a Tor exit node, and they just siphoned documents off the Tor exit node. The same could be happening with the VPN. Whoever is running that could be siphoning off what, copying your stream coming off it. They could be keeping logs. For all you know, the IFPI or the RIAA, the MPAA, the Business Software Association, whoever could be running that, or Anti-Piratbyrån. Sorry, in Sweden, for instance, if it's hosted in Sweden, they could be on it, logging it, sending it over to whoever.
And if you really want to know the answer of how to be completely anonymous on the net, come to a DC404 meeting. We'd be happy to talk to you about it. It's actually quite easy to do.
Okay. Another option is block lists. Anybody use block lists? Like PeerBlock or PeerDefender? Waste of time. What they use is they have people who go out and look for suspicious-looking peers. And they'll say, okay, that one looks like they're logging, they're doing bad things, so we're going to add them to a block list. Except they're not. So in 2007, Media Defender, California-based anti-P2P company, had its systems email leak, had an email leak, and a list of all their servers and all their IP addresses that they were using came out. That is the only time we've ever had a hard source of what any anti-P2P company has ever used for tracking BitTorrents. They put it against the leading list, done by Blue Tech Internet Security Solutions. They do the peer block list, the main one that's included, the anti-PW list. It was Slick went and tested the list. They found that less than 2% of what was actually used for anti-P2P was marked in these lists as being anti-P2P. These lists were so long, they had one third of the internet in them. So that meant you were actually more likely to connect to them using these lists because you've blocked off a third of the 31% of the internet and 2% of the, you know. Then in 2008, the University of Washington did a study, and you may all heard about this with the network printers and the wireless routers getting the DMCA notices. If you'd have read the study, you'd have read that they did two tests. They did one when they first, when they were doing another study, and then they did the second one for comparison 9 months later. The one 9 months later, they used a block list. In the first one, they had one in, I think it was 180 torrents. They got a DMCA notice, are the ones they were playing around with. When they used the block list the second time, it was one in 90. The instances of DMCA notices doubled while they were using the block list. And that's something the block list makers won't tell you. They, if you post it to their forums, they will delete that post. That, hey, I was using your block list and I got a letter. What can I do? Delete. They don't want you to know. They want the money. I've been trying to track who BlueTac is for the last 4 years. They're hidden in a post office box somewhere in England in a virtual office next to a law firm. Draw your own conclusions. So, other ways to hide. There's Tor. Don't use Tor. Well, use it for the tracker announce, but if you use it for the actual bandwidth, for the actual transfer, you're going to kill the Tor network. Each time you go through a hop, you're using up more bandwidth and more bandwidth, and it's just going to bring the entire... The Tor net people get really, really peeved if you if you use the Tor network for actually peer-to-peer transfers.
Shouldn't having more traffic running through Tor create better security for Tor, because it makes it harder to do timing analysis and all kinds of other things that if you just hide in a sea of peer-to-peer file transfer?
Sure, if they've got unlimited bandwidth. If they've only got a limited amount of bandwidth, though, and you've completely clogged it up with peer-to-peer traffic, then that means the people in, say, Libya or, you know, places where they're trying to get critical information out and connect can't, because... You know, you're trying to download, I don't know, the latest Justin Bieber music track or, you know, My Little Pony episodes or something like that.
I've read the front page and whatnot, but I missed that panel. Can you tell me what exactly is Tor?
Tor stands for the Onion Router, and it's basically a... I don't use it myself, and I've never really dabbled with it much, but it's basically a system. It's like a VPN into a closed network, is how I understand it, and it shuttles the traffic along between nodes in the network through different layers, and then it all eventually funnels out through an exit node. And exit nodes can be run by different people.
We operate in an exit node.
Well, tell us about the tool.
Oh, okay. The Onion Routing Network. Essentially, the idea is this. It was developed between EFF and the U.S. Navy. And the idea is they wanted to have a way that dissidents in countries or people that might be there you want to talk to and not have the government track them, leave it at that, had to have a way of connecting from one place on the internet to another without being able to analyze the traffic and determine where the source of that traffic was. If you can imagine you're a dissident in say, China, and you're leaking information out about what the government's doing of human rights violations or something, well, if the Chinese government got that information, they're going to show up at your door and you're toast. Okay? So the way this works is you create an encrypted connection to the Tor entrance node. the Tor entrance node then randomly selects multiple machines within its network of registered Tor servers, where it creates an encrypted, and they're geographically dispersed. That means if you're trying to get logs, which they don't keep, they're booted off a CD. There
some
are different
anyway.
Jurisdictions, which they're not going to give you the data anyway, even if they had it. So it goes, creates an encrypted connection to the next node. That node only knows it got an encrypted connection from that guy. He doesn't know where the traffic came from. He just got data from him, right? It then, and the data is encrypted, so he can't see what it is. Well, it repeats that process jumping around the country, kind of like you see in the movies where they're bouncing off servers all over. Although you really can't display it like that. Yeah. Anyway, they bounce it off a bunch of these, and then finally it goes to a Tor exit node where it all gets decrypted and your actual traffic pops out. Now, it is possible if you captured the traffic at the exit node, if you gave up information in your browser or whatever tool you're using was giving up information, like it says my username, my IP address locally, things like that, it can leak information if you were at the exit node. But there's no way to predict where that exit node will be. An example is, let's say I go to, we'll pick on Wikipedia since we like them. The reason Wikipedia won't let you do that is because people would use it to get around being banned from Wikipedia for being bozos. And so they don't allow connections because all the exit nodes are registered. And it's part of due diligence that if they're going to do a DMCA takedown notice, one of the requirements is they have to do due diligence, and if there's a thing like an exit node, it's registered, they have to look it up and say, oh, that's not really somebody I can go after, so I can't send the DMCA takedown notice. That's not true. They don't do their due diligence, and I got a takedown notice for my Tor node. Okay, so, which is part of sponsored research, by the way. So if somebody's paying for us to do that. So the idea is, though, if I'm going to a website like Wikipedia, for instance, the traffic is HTTP. So once it pops out that exit node, it's unencrypted traffic. It goes across the network. So anybody between here and there could see that traffic. And if Wikipedia says, hi, here's your cookie, what's your IP address and your username, what plugins do you have, your browser's happily going to give that up, and it's going to be in the IP traffic when it popped out the other side. Unless you used HTTPS, then that whole data stream right to the server is encrypted. And at that point, they can't tell. So if you really want to be anonymous, you use an anonymous operating system over Tor. Now, there's some more things involved in that, but come to DC 404 meeting, we'll explain it. What happens in that case, an anonymous operating system says you're using a Timex Sinclair using Chrome. For you, those who know, Timex Sinclair is a little Z80 command line only thing about this big. About everything about your system, so that there's no way they can fingerprint who you are on this end. But I highly recommend you, as Andrew said, do not do torrents over Tor. But it will hide very effectively where you're coming from.
Okay. So that answered the question? Or did he left,
yeah.
I think. Oh.
Oh, well. I scared him off.
Oh.
No, that was his question.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. Right. He moved, is what he did.
Ah. Yeah.
What are the legalities of downloading foreign copyright material that isn't licensed in this country, like an anime that isn't licensed in America?
The legality is going to vary depending on what country you're licensing it from, or you're downloading it from, mm-hmm. or... not where you're downloading, but where it's produced. I mean, most countries have some type of treaty relationship. There's the vast likelihood is that it will be subject to all the same illegalities as U.S. copyright law, but that's not 100% true. That's not 100% the case, and certainly... as you are probably aware, China has a very different view of copyright law than we do. But that doesn't mean China's okay with you taking their stuff. So it's going to vary depending on where the material is created, but the sort of baseline answer is probably assume it's just as illegal as it is in the U.S. or the U.K. or any other.
Beware of something called optioning. They buy the option, which is not the same thing as buying the rights, but it will allow them to come after you somehow. So,
just not available doesn't mean it's not licensed.
Right. Well, and the other thing too is to remember that a large part of, and if you were here in the last talk, we had all the jurisdictional discussions, but a large part of the copyright infringement is going to be based on where the harm occurs. So if you're downloading French material, then obviously French law has some relationship. But if you're downloading French material in Wyoming, then the federal laws of the United States are also going to be applicable in certain situations. So a lot of jurisdictional questions come out about downloading content from the internet. And if you're sitting in your living room, you probably ought to assume you're subject to U.S. laws. You may also be subject to someone else's laws, but that's your safe bet.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if this is going to reveal my ignorance or make me look like a smart person. To the semi-layperson, software like iTunes, sites like Netflix, I think are sort of seen as a compromise between copyright theft on the web and big RIA.
It's not theft, it's infringement. There's a big difference. Yes, okay. You can actually steal copyright. Okay. Warner Brothers was accused of it about 2 years ago, and okay. Canadian publishers have been just on a $50 million settlement for doing it over the last 20 years, but it's infringement, it's not theft.
Okay. Well, at any rate, these technologies and software and these sites, to the layman, are seen as sort of a compromise between those who are going after every single kind of bit sharing on the web and those who are downloading illegal material, basically. And I was wondering how well are they seen to work as far as preventing illegal activity.
Well, as far as preventing, no, you can't prevent illegal activity.
Lowering it,
I think that iTunes are pretty. It's doing a pretty good job.
Yeah, we did Torrent. We did a study about 2 weeks ago. Anybody here use Hulu?
Every day.
Anybody use it to watch Fox shows, like Hell's Kitchen? That's the only new show. That and there's one other new show on. About 3 weeks ago, Fox decided to put a new policy on Hulu. Instead of shows the day after, it's 8 days after. And that's going to be, I believe that's going to be for the whole new season of shows, this thing. So we decided to take a look at BitTorrent traffic for this new show. And it turned out there was a five-fold increase in BitTorrent traffic in the US for these shows once the new policy came into place.
That was a big enough spike that Hurricane Electric saw a jump in total internet bandwidth when they made that change.
Mm-hmm. It does help a lot. I mean, I use Hulu every day, and you know, I live out in the boons. And
I think, given the choice. We're actually recording this session, so he sounds like a loon talking to nobody. Okay.
I think given the choice, most people would prefer a legitimate way to get their movies, their shows, their music. You know, iTunes is very easy to use. You just go there and, you know, sorry.
Was that a wince?
Yeah, it was.
Okay, I use Hulu all the time as well. And most people, given a legitimate choice that they don't have to be scared that they're doing something illegal, would choose that, and it seems like the RIAA, the MPAA aren't getting that at all.
That's really a large part of the problem, is we're trying to deal with a sea change in business model, in business thinking. And, you know, the music industry is used to selling albums, because when you had to make it out of pressed vinyl, you wanted to put more than one or two songs on things, you could get a lot more bang for your buck. Now that we're not really doing that anymore, the album mentality is gone in the music buying public. In fact, most people don't want the other 12 crappy songs on the CD. Then it makes it that much more enticing to go get the one good song you want. And if I can go get the one good song I want for 99 cents or 79 cents or whatever, you know, free, if I can get it somewhere legally and free, fantastic, I'm going to. But you're never going to absolutely prevent it, because there are still going to be people who don't want to pay 99 cents. But it's a phenomenal change in the infringement rate, because there are people who have an anti-copyright mentality and are doing it for a philosophical reason. There are also a bunch of broke teenagers, and you know, if broke teenagers have another alternative that's legal, they're going to use it.
Okay, so Netflix asks, when you're canceling your subscription, why you're canceling, and one of those options is for bootlegging. Now, does Netflix give your information to the government or anybody if you select that option when you cancel your subscription?
Why would you select it? Just don't check that box.
Well, I've never paid for Netflix, never used it before. It's just something that I've seen in the news, though. And I wanted to ask about it.
Well, I mean, what Netflix does with the information, I don't know, because I don't know their business model. But I would certainly be surprised if someone doesn't come and get it. If Netflix is collecting that information, if I want it in a litigation sense, I'm going to subpoena it.
Okay, for those of you
who
that is the special feature... that tells us the battery has gone dead. So, but we have a whole bag of batteries. Isn't that wonderful? It doesn't beep or do something kind, like a little voice come on and say your battery's dead.
Well, I thought that was the bagpipe serenade.
Drunk bagpipe.
But you know, so what Netflix does with it, whether or not Netflix even treats it as a joke, but if there's a Netflix file somewhere that says, I'm leaving to bootleg things, and I know you were on Netflix, and I'm suing you on behalf of someone else, I'm going to subpoena Netflix to see if you were dumb enough to check that box. So, don't check the box.
Yeah.
Or wait, if I'm suing you, please check the box.
All right. I do have a quick question about TV shows and a letter I got from Comcast.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Gotten a lot of those calls.
I
must be sending the letters.
I do various downloads. I'm not going to say legal or illegal, but
let's just say, for the point of argument, they were all the EFF tracks. Okay.
Okay. All right. They were all EFF tracks. There you go. But I did download a season one of Warehouse 13. Everything I download, they send me an email saying, don't download it again.
Yeah.
A TV show, really?
That's one of the ones I've seen most common. In fact, I actually got sent a letter for season two, episode one of Warehouse 13 right before DragonCon last year. I didn't download it. I was pinging some trackers to get some information for my job, but they sent me a letter because some of the ways they collect is just to pull IPs off the tracker.
Mm-hmm. And not trying to put you on the spot, but have you personally ever done any illegal downloading? We would like to know. Answer honestly.
In the past, I have. I used to actually moderate for Mininova many years ago. I used to moderate for them, and I used to work with one or two other similar sites. But on the other flip side, the way I got started in all this was in the late 90s. I actually worked for what was my uncle's record company as a copyright enforcer. I started out doing physical.
He had the bat. It was nasty.
I did physical music piracy, usually cabaret artists around the Mediterranean. When I was in college, it meant I could go around the Mediterranean. You know, I could go around, I could enforce, you know, you're doing a cover version, you're trying to sell CDs yourself, That's infringement. Pay up.
I'm too technology illiterate. I can barely figure out how to use Hulu. So, but now those letters are they come in spurts, and you know every couple of months or every year I'll get a rash of calls. This was the month the RIAA sent the letters. This is the month the MPAA sent the letters. I've got a letter from Comcast saying that they've had my IP, that they've had their a subpoena sent, and they're going to release my IP. So do I object? Well, you know, probably not, because it's a subpoena and there's not a whole lot you can say. No, don't give it to them because I don't want you to find out that I may be guilty of something. That's not a very good argument in court. But frankly, the information that they're looking for is not all that useful, because just knowing that your IP was used to download things, well, you know, my job is to argue, and I can think of lots of reasons your IP might have been used, and it has nothing to do with your illegal downloads. Don't save them on your hard drive, because then defeat all my arguments, but that we can think of a lot of ways to get out of those. The problem is that in order to do that, you come to me and you write me a big check and I go make those arguments for you. And that's what makes the RIAA and the MPAA so successful in this, is that they come around and say, hey, you've downloaded our music, you did it illegally, and I'm going to sue you and get my full statutory damages of $150,000 per infringement and drag you through the federal litigation process, or you can simply cut me a check for $3,500 and I'll go away. Then you come to me and I tell you that it's going to cost much, much more than $3,500 to raise all the defenses that we can think of, and you write them a check for $3,500 and they go away. Right or wrong, whether or not you actually downloaded that song, or whether or not what you did was legal, or whether or not what you did was fair use, or any of the other arguments, it's an economic argument, and the economics factor into the little guy usually can't afford to fund it.
Mm-hmm. This is actually a process that's been called speculative invoicing. It started out in the UK in 2007 with a firm called Davenport Lyons, and it was a 3D Dream Pinball was the game. It was a $10 game, and they sent out letters. They wanted £500, and they never actually took anybody to court. Well, they took six people to court. They got one judgment of £10,000, which is $16,000, roughly, and five more of $10,000, roughly, and they were default judgments. The people didn't show. There was no argument raised. They asked for it, they got it. And they used that, they sent out 20, 30,000 more. Well, Atari just got onto it as well, they used them. And then a year or so later, another law firm got involved, and the original one stopped. And then people started getting letters for hardcore pornography. Actually, pornography that's illegal in Britain to own or distribute. And people started complaining and going to things like the Consumer Association and to the BBC and raising all kinds of noise about it. And 2 years ago, the lawyer behind the second firm was saying, yeah, I'm making, you know, seven figures a year from this. People paying up what is legalized extortion. And then last year, Anonymous hit the servers and then took their website down. And then the website administrator went trying to restore it, put up a copy of their IMAP database with their emails, and they downloaded it. And one of the emails what included was from the technical guy to the lead lawyer, you know, what are we doing with all these cases? We can't really prosecute them because we don't actually have the evidence we say we do. Two of the lawyers involved in that scheme were disbarred for 2 years a few months ago. Another was the lawyer behind the main scheme was declared himself bankrupt. For the leak of the email, they were hit by the privacy commissioner. And the lawyer is looking at losing his law license and possibly facing a jail term. At this time, we'll find out what happens in November. Now, this has come to the US, and there's about five or six companies now doing it, and they are not having so great, and again, it comes down to jurisdiction again. Some of them specialize in pornography, others on games, and they've had a lot of jurisdictional issues because they consider anybody who's been on this on any BitTorrent dealing this one title, could be 20 different torrents, you're all one person, you're all one group, we're going to see you all as one group. There's 32,000, was it, in one group? Mm-hmm. It was what company versus John Doe's 1 to 32,000. In DC? Is it DC?
Yeah. No. That's not an uncommon tactic, though. In most infringement cases, they're alleging infringement. That's the kind of allegations you're going to get. That's why you get one name company and millions of John Does, or we'll fill in the names later. It happens even down to tangible products. You're bringing infringing products in through customs. We're going to send a lawsuit to everybody who has ever gotten a letter from customs, and we're going to assume that more people are involved, and we're going to add in a couple hundred John Does. It's just, and in practice, it comes down to who's willing to pay to fight it versus who's willing to just respond to the letter.
All that having been said, then, why don't they do it even more often? Like you said that they send out these letters in spurts, like the RIAA and the MPAA sending out, you'll get a whole bunch of calls at once and then not for a while. Why aren't they constantly sending out letters to tons of people? What's stopping them?
I don't know, they might just not be calling me. The issue, I think, is, I mean, legally, it costs a whole lot of money to bring the litigation as well. So, for the most part, while your letter is going to threaten willful infringement, $150,000 per infringement, and I'm going to get my attorney's fees, as a practical matter, you're never going to get that award. That's not something the judge is going to give. I can't say never, but pretty close to never. It might be a lot of money, but it's not going to be anywhere near what they're claiming. And I think that the companies who engage in this type of legalized extortion know that if we hit people, you know, a couple of thousand at a time, then they'll all just pay up, and no one's gonna. If we send a letter to everybody in the United States all at once, people will talk and they'll figure out that there's no way we're going to sue 3 billion people all at one time, and that all of this is really just a tactic to get you to write me a check for whatever you'll write me a check for.
And there is another issue as well, that it's, they don't send you the letter, they can send you a letter through your ISP, say, we've got this IP address. They'll send that through, but when they send you the threatening letter that's got your name on it, that's already been through the courts once.
Right.
And they've done the ex parte discovery. And some ISPs, I think it's Time Warner, has come to an agreement where they'll only do 31 or 45 of these lookups of who was using that at a time per month. So that's substantially cut down their ability to send out the letters.
Well, I wanted to add to that something I read 5 years ago, that anyone responding to those letters, like, you know, they ask for the $3,000, they ask for you to sign that you'll never do this again, they ask you, well, you're admitting that you did it, and that they will have the right to come back and sue you again or prosecute you in some form or fashion for the rest of your life. The advice that I've read was, don't ever give in, don't ever sign, don't ever, you know, pay them that small fee. I guess hire a lawyer.
Where did you read that? Was it?
It was a posting 5 years ago.
Wanted to make it wrong, I guess.
That's okay.
Many years ago, 5 years ago, I believe it was a posting when all of this was coming out, it would have been under the advice column, what do you do if you get one of these letters? Oh my gosh. Yeah. So well, that's what I retained from that.
And the reality is, of course, that if you do get a letter, you don't go talk to anyone, you just send them a check, which is what most people do. The release that's going to be drafted is going to be drafted by the RIAA's lawyers in an RIAA situation, MBAA, whatever other group you're looking at. And now obviously it's going to be very strongly in their favor and not so in favor of the purported infringer. And that's, you know, it's just another reason why sometimes having people look over what you're going to sign is a good idea. But yeah, I wouldn't doubt at all that the documents that you're going to get directly from these companies are terribly pro-company.
Has anybody won one of these lawsuits, you know, where they're going after a user who downloaded stuff? Or is it just costing them more to pursue us than they're ever getting?
Are you asking if any of the companies have won?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They've won, but so the most famous is Jamie Thomas Rassett, mm-hmm. who shared 24 songs on Kazaa. Supposedly shared 24 songs. It's not been fully decided yet. It just went to appeal last week after the third trial. This case has been going on since 2006. In the first trial in 2007, she went to jury trial and was dinged for $222,000. They appealed that, or had a retrial because the judge's instructions to the jury was wrong, and it went to a second jury trial, $1.92 million in damages, $80,000 per track.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The judge reduced that to $54,000, I think.
It was in the
54,000, and the RIA appealed that, so it went to a third trial last year on damages only, where it went to $1.5 million.
Mm.
In total, and the judge in March reduced that again back down to $54,000 under the excessive fines,
right?
Excessive punishments thing.
So they haven't actually gotten any money yet.
No,
not out of that.
Are they ever going to get any money?
Oh, then she's a single mother who works for the government. She's never going to pay $1.92 million.
She's going to pay $54,000. That's it though. A lot of these are showboat trials. They get people who they have very, very clear evidence, and who they can make a very good, compelling, willful case against, and end up with a judgment that's $1.5 million. So I can turn around and say, if you don't settle with me, I'm going to get $1.5 million. Right. So they win cases all the time. Winning a case, winning a judgment is a very different question from collecting a judgment,
yes.
As any of my clients can tell you. But the situation of default judgments being the vast majority of things that go to court on these, the ones who do go fight, you know, it takes a lot of money to win a copyright defense. And on the flip side of that coin, though, there are a number of groups, legal groups or law firms that have taken on to oppose these types of litigations.
Kiwi Kamara.
Yeah.
For one. He's doing the Thomas trial pro bono.
Mm-hmm. And they'll take the case. They'll take the case to defend without fees. They'll lump a number of people together to bring class action suits and be able to use those funds instead of individual funding. So there's a lot of activity on both sides of the V in these cases. But at the end of the day, it's a pretty effective business model.
And we should point out that while you got the Thomas case, you got the Joel Tenenbaum case, sort of one, there have also been cases where they've lost.
Mm-hmm.
Foster was one. They ended up getting $108,000 in legal fees awarded to them because they accused her she hadn't infringed. They decided to settle out, dismiss it with prejudice, and she got her legal fees. It took 3 years, and they were phoning up. They phoned up her kid's school and impersonated their grandparents and things like that to get them to admit it, but they ended up dismissing it with prejudice. Mm-hmm. So they lost that case effectively.
And that's it. I mean, the same arguments of how you can, all the defense arguments that we can raise about how your IP address may have gotten on these lists, all the fair use arguments we can raise, there's a lot of risk to actual litigation. At the end of the day, most of these companies don't want to sue the vast majority of the people they're sending letters to. Like you said, they're not suing anybody. They don't even have the evidence to sue somebody. Now, not all of them are that bad. There's usually enough evidence to at least bring a good faith case, but if I can't be guaranteed of winning, I'm sure not going to want to go spend a couple $100,000 on litigation, certainly not against somebody who's never going to be able to pay me if I win. So it's not necessarily in anyone's best interest to bring this litigation.
Now, until you...
It's
the lawyer's best interest.
Which is perfectly fine with me.
Until you get the DMCA notice with your personal information on it, is it better just not to respond to the other ones before that?
You're not going to see the other ones. They're not going to know who you are to mail you anything. If you get a letter, it's going to be because they've got some suggestion that you personally downloaded some content.
Well, no. There is the kind that have been sent directly to the ISP, and then the ISP has forwarded it on. That's the first type of letter.
I see. Yeah.
Yeah. Ignore them, generally. Yeah. Sometimes send a nice thing. Yeah, we received that. Don't know what it's doing. You know, no clue. That's right. Yeah. That one letter I received last year, that's what I did to AT&T. Sorry, wasn't infringing. They got it wrong. I can give you all this evidence if you want. But, you know.
Yeah, we get DMCA takedown notices all the time and at a university. And basically, most people don't understand the process. What happens is an ISP or anybody who's operating a network can be held liable is that the right word, for the content. And the way that the law is written, the way they can get out of the mess, so to speak, is they have to have what's called a registered agent. And they've actually gone and registered a name and address, phone number, contact person for that organization. And then when a DMCA takedown notice says, hey, that came from Comcast, so they give that to the DMCA agent. And then what that person does is they say, to get out of the hot water, they have to say, you have to tell us who the person is that's responsible for this traffic. And they simply, we just turn around and say, oh, it was him. And we give that back to them. And we are also responsible, for instance, like YouTube, in taking down the infringing stuff. We block it. Now, he has the recourse of saying, no, that's not infringing. And that's all he has to do. He just tells us, no, that's not infringing. And we immediately put it right back up. And at that point, if they come back and say, no, it really is infringing, we go, well, we don't care. It's between you two. We gave you the information, at which point we step out of the way, and they fight it out. And that's the way the law works, so that we're not liable for something somebody put up that we have no control over. That's the way it works.
So that's how they get your name.
Right. When I look at, like, the Thomas case and everything, I've always been curious on how they get to those numbers, because they just seem extremely high, but I'm not sure I don't have any basis of that argument. So I was curious how they get to that high of a number per song.
They make them up.
Yep.
Yeah. Statutory damages.
Because here's the thing with copyright. You're entitled to two types of damages under copyright law. You're entitled to actual damages, which can be based on money that you've lost in sales or revenues, or profits that they've made in sales or revenues. And if I can show that there was money lost or profit made, then that can be one measure of my damages. That's the actual money. In some of these instances, that's impossible to prove with any certainty. How many sales would I have made of the copies that, you know, would I have actually sold a copy to you if you downloaded it? I don't know. Would you actually bought it? How are we ever going to prove that? How much money did you make off of it? Nothing. So there really aren't any actual damages to go with in a lot of copyright cases. And so what the law has provided for is a calculation of statutory damages. And statutory damages, they go from $750 to $30,000, unless it's willful, in which case it goes from
$750 to $150,000.
But it got up to $150,000.
$750 to.
Is it $750 for willful damage? Yeah. So the baseline number, you're always going to get some minimum damages. But it can be up to $150,000 per infringement. And that's, you know, so again, per file. And that's what got the you know, you start multiplying things by 24, you get to big numbers pretty quickly. So that's the basis for those. Now, how do you determine those statutory damage numbers? I ask for 150, and they give me whatever that they want to give me. It's completely made up.
In the Thomas trial, the jury just pulled a number out of their head. One of the jurors said to Wired afterwards, we knew she was lying. She started talking about zombies, and we were like, what? You're just lying, woman. And they just hit her with $222,000.
How do they actually detect your IP address? Is it because the torrent directs you to a server of that they own that has the information on it?
They generally use what's called a logging bot. And basically, it's a client just like yours. Exactly like yours. They can be on it, run the torrent client. In fact, uTorrent, muTorrent, microtorrent, whatever you want to call it, you can actually configure that to work as a logging client. It takes 6 clicks. That's all it takes. And they just have to run it on that torrent, watch the traffic, watch the peers you're sharing with, and it'll actually log down for you the IP address, the time, the date, the torrent you were on. They could monitor 100 torrents at once if they wanted to.
So that's if you're seeding or if you're downloading?
That's if you're just, well, with BitTorrent, while you're downloading, you're also uploading. That's what makes it so efficient, because it's split into lots and lots of little pieces all the way down to 16 kilobyte chunks, and it's that which you're swapping backwards and forwards.
So they are searching the content you're downloading, and then they're looking for the traffic regarding that content.
Well, they're just on the torrent. The torrent file itself is specific to that content.
No.
So they're just running that specific torrent. They might run 20 different torrents, all of the same film, I don't know, Iron Man 3 or, you know, Star Trek 96.
So it's not necessarily how much content you got. It's just they detect you got one piece.
And as long as they see some traffic from you, sharing to and from, that's all it is. I actually put a video up... Right at DragonCon last year, we put her up on Torrent Freak, and I showed you exactly how they can use uTorrent to track you. And it was meant to show how much these block lists are ineffective, because they could use any connection in the world. They don't have to do it. The MPAA doesn't have to use the MPAA servers in Hollywood, in California. They could go home, do it. They could be on the Wi-Fi here and do it. I could go home to my house and have it do up my DSL, and I could monitor 200,000 torrents at once if I really, really wanted to. In fact, the more the better, because then I'm not sharing, and therefore I'm not potentially giving you a license by uploading to you, as I'm a licensed distributor. So that's how they track you.
So that's just basically off your IP address at the time you download it.
Yeah. They literally watch you do it.
Yeah, there's nothing to prevent a lawyer who works for the RIAA or MPA from going home and running this on his machine and collecting the data.
So you keep calling this like legalized extortion. What is the distinction there? And are there lawyers who've made mistakes and said things like, oh, we don't really have evidence, but we're going to do this anyway, that have been disbarred or even charged for extortion? But that's not an American case.
Well,
I was wondering.
It hasn't gotten that far. It started in the UK in 2006 or 7. It only started here late 2009. And what happened there was, in the UK, was they got hit by Anonymous last year and their email leaked out. And the guy restoring their website to a new server had their email IMAP file for their email server was on there. It was just a 400 megabyte chunk of email, and included just that snippet, and that made the case.
So what are the things that a American company or lawyer could do that would push them into actually being extortion?
Well,
doing it without any legitimate evidence is going to be a big part of that. I mean, if you try to send out these demand letters without any actual basis, then you're gonna have a real issue. But the reality is that you don't necessarily need to have a whole lot of evidence when you start a case. and I can prove that this IP address belongs to you, and this IP address was used to download 70 files of infringing content. Now, if we go to court over this, are you going to tell me that it wasn't, you know, you had an open IP network, somebody was sitting in your driveway? Or is the jury going to believe that? Is there a fair use argument? Is there any other argument? There's a lot of things that are going to happen at trial. But whether or not I win is not the same as whether or not I can actually bring you into court and begin the discovery process. I have to have a very low amount of information before I go into discovery. So that's why I'm calling it legalized extortion, because really it's legal. You can show that there was a file downloaded. You can show that this person more likely than not participated in the downloading based on IP address ownership. That's probably going to be enough to get you into court. And so the threat that I'm going to sue you and bring you into court is real. In terms of practical aspects, is that company going to actually sue you and bring you into court? I personally believe that the chances of that are pretty low, just because of the costs involved, the economics involved in recovery. I think that it's unlikely they'll sue you. It doesn't mean that they won't. And if they do, then you're not guaranteed to win. So that's what makes the payoffs more appealing. It costs less than hiring me to defend you against it, and it avoids the risk of the $1 million judgment against you.
Now, there was a ruling that came out, I think, the last month, where a judge ruled that an IP address is not a person.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And
that was in the Expendables case.
Right. Now, that's not based on IP version 4. So IP version 6 may change that. We'll see. But it's only one judge. So
right.
This may, we'll see how this watershed happens. It will be interesting. So you want to watch that case. Well, we've unfortunately run out of time.
Well,
so
I think we can squeeze one in. One more in.
Oh, you had one more question. Okay, one more question. Go
ahead. I may be remembering this wrong, but was there a case of somebody set up a printer with an IP address and they sued the printer?
Yeah, that was okay. University of Washington's, it's called the DMCA study. It's dmca.cs.wash.edu, I think.
Yeah, we did get a takedown notice on our Tor exit node once.
They don't often check the exit nodes.
They're
always
required to.
They're required, but they don't have to. It's a registered server.
They're supposed to do that, but they didn't.
Got it. Thanks.
Okay. Oh, excellent. So, well, thank you all for coming, and let's thank our panelists. And have a happy rest of the con, those of you who are still awake.